is Lars, and I'm listening to Type Radio, and now we're talking.
Hello, my name is Matthew Carter. You are listening to Type Radio, now we're talking.
Yeah. So what was the lie?
I started my talk by showing two different letters, and I pretended that they had been made with different tools. But this was a deliberate lie, because I then wanted to say, this is bullshit, and one of them was... They were both made on a computer. I had pretended that one of them had been made by hand, when in fact that was not true. But I wanted the audience to go along with me and then see, you know, why I was telling a lie, to make them understand better what the point I was trying to make.
So it's lying...
Lying with a purpose.
Yeah,
lying,
for the sake of
for the truth. Lying for the sake of the truth.
Wow, that's very noble then, I suppose. you said no to the does money make the world go round question. Is that a realistic point of view, or like more like a wishful and idealistic point of view?
I suppose it's some of both. It's a difficult question to answer because... It begs the question, what you mean by making the world go round? I suppose in my world, it doesn't make a very big difference. If you wanted to talk about corporate America or politics and so on, I suppose I would have to be more cynical and say, yes, you can't observe American party politics and so on without realizing that obviously money has a great deal to do with it. Mm. Yeah. But in my own world, I have to make a living, and you know, so do most of the people I know. But I don't think I am someone who is typically very driven by the need to make a lot of money and so on. My life is not really organized with that in view. Mm. Really.
But concluding out of what you say is... You sort of consider the type world to be a separate thing, a separate universe in a way. So the answer to this question is like setting these worlds apart. While of course they're connected and intertwined.
Of course they're connected, but I always have to be on my guard about generalizing about type and type design. I mean, we happen to be in a place today where there are a lot of type designers and people interested in type design, and it's easy to get a false impression of the world because there are very knowledgeable people here, and I can have conversations with all sorts of people about these professional matters and so on. But when you go outside the doors here into the wider world of Berlin or Germany or wherever, this is not the case. The preoccupations that we have, the obsessions we have professionally, are not things that concern people very much. What we do is typically rather anonymous. Since the coming of computers, most people know what a font is. You know, for most of my life, if I said I was a type designer, a general conversation at a party or a dinner or something or other, mm-hmm. no one would have the slightest idea what I meant. Mm-hmm. But now if I find myself sitting next to, I don't know, a stranger on a plane who asks what I do, and I say I work with fonts, at least they know what it is. They don't necessarily know that there's any human agency involved in doing it. They think they sort of come out of the software ether in some magical way.
They fall from the sky.
But you can have an intelligent conversation with a 10-year-old now about fonts and so on, which is a very different world. But even so, it is not... You know, I make this distinction between our rather parochial, insular world of people who are interested in type and knowledgeable and so on, which is why we all come to these conferences. But outside that world, it's not generally appreciated.
Does that bother you?
No.
Because as a reality.
I've always, I very early in my life, I read something that influenced me a lot. It was written by a great British typographic authority of the previous generation, Stanley Morrison. And he said that printing was invented to multiply information. And that is the art. The multiplication is the art of printing. And I thought that was very interesting. It's almost a sort of Marxist view of it, because by the art of printing, most people think of fine printing, special editions, deluxe, limited editions, and beautiful corporate annual reports and so on. But that's never really been what interests me about this business. I'm much more interested in the industrial end of it, in the screen fonts I've been doing for Microsoft, I was talking about today, and in newspaper faces, in faces for the telephone books and so on, very functional and utilitarian things. So those are largely anonymous, and quite rightly, because people who look up a number in the phone book, they're not concerned with who was responsible. I mean, they can read it or they can't read it, you know.
Yeah.
It's a matter that should be transparent to them, subliminal, and so on. So I think it's right that, as a generalization, type designer's work is not tremendously well known. It is better known now than when I was young, because of computers, as I say, but it is still a largely anonymous profession.
Okay.
You mentioned newspaper fonts.
Yes.
When they're, if one of your fonts is misused, would you advise them that this is you're not doing this properly?
Sometimes yes, sometimes no. What usually happens when you get involved in the redesign of a newspaper or a magazine, there will be some exchange. I mean, obviously, I will deliver the fonts to them, but then they will generally show me some proofs and so on, and if I then see anything that doesn't look right in the way they're using the type, then of course I will tell them so. And when you are designing a typeface for newspapers are a very good example, you can't really be confident that it's right until the typeface has been all the way through their production system. In other words, I can look at laser printer proofs of a typeface I'm working on at home, and I can say, I think this is right, I think the weight is right, the density is right. But then it's only when I give it to them and they typeset it in their system, they print it on their presses with their ink, their paper, and then they show it to me that I can say, yes, this is okay, or no, it isn't, I have to change some things and so on. So there is always this iterative process of confirming in the real circumstances of production, because different newspapers vary from one to another, how they're printed, how attentive they are to various quality control issues and so on. Looking at things in real life is very important. And yes, sometimes you do see things that need to be tweaked, need to be changed.
Mm. But you don't get upset about it. I mean, you're not...
Well. No, but that maybe is because I've been doing this for so long. and I would have to say that if you are a type designer, you make a raw material. I mean, I design typefaces, then they go out in the world. If I've designed a typeface on a custom basis for a magazine, of course I know how they're going to use it, but generally typefaces go out and I have no idea where they're going. As I said at the end of my talk, sometimes designers will come up to me and say, oh, I've used your typeface in such a job, but I don't necessarily know them or know their work and so on. So it's a strange sort of anonymous collaboration with people. So as a type designer, you depend a lot on the feedback you see from seeing your type in use. You know, if I go into a bookstore, maybe I'll pick up a book and find it set in a face of mine or a CD cover or whatever it is, and I will very often look at that critically in order to see whether it's performing well and so on, because that's how I learn, by seeing something in action. So I would say that in my experience that has been, broadly speaking, a good experience, I mean a pleasing experience for me, not always, of course. And when it isn't a pleasing experience, it is usually because someone has misused a typeface. They've put it in a situation where it can't really work. Let me think of an example. If you could be setting black text on white paper in a certain typeface, and then, as many magazines do, you might want to make a little box, a dropout, where it's reversed, where the background is black or a dark color and the type is white. Well, if you use the same typeface at the same size, very often it will break down when it's reversed. And if I see that, that's very annoying to me because the designer has been careless. They've put this typeface in a situation where it must fail. Therefore, it makes it a bad typeface in that. So they should have used a larger size or a bolder weight or a sans serif or any number of different
options,
yeah. options mm-hmm. to make that better. So I don't have this idea that there are, in absolute sense, good typefaces and bad typefaces. It's much more relative to me. I see examples of faces, I mean, my own and other people's, which are well used, and I see examples which are badly used. And sometimes bad use is annoying for the reasons that I give. It's just someone hasn't taken the trouble to think about this and so on. But then I would have to back off, as I said, and say that, you know, over the long haul, it's been a good reaction on the whole. And by the way, you sometimes learn more from seeing typefaces used badly than seeing them used well, because sometimes, as I say, they're put in difficult situations and you see things about them that perhaps you could improve.
Yeah. Now you're talking about the technical side of the usage of the fonts.
Yes, but yes.
I sometimes sort of philosophize about the whole idea of like your font being used for a cause that you don't support. Like if like the Bush administration would like put out a war on some paper and would use a font of yours, things like that. You think it's a possibility ever to have like sort of restrict usage of the font for?
I don't think so. You can't really have the font police. I don't think you can police things in that way. I mean, I have had that experience. I mean, I think this is a thing that exercises graphic designers much more than type designers, because, you know, graphic designers have clients more in a way than we do, and you might be approached by some company whose products you didn't like or whose politics you didn't like. Mm-hmm. And as you know, there is a lot of feeling among graphic designers now about that, about not supporting causes that they don't agree in. It's harder for type designers because, well, I'll give you a funny example. Many years ago now, in the United States, they did a mailing. The Surgeon General, who's in charge of the whole sort of health policy in the States, did a mailing. I think at that time it was the biggest mailing that had ever been done to American households, and it was about AIDS, but very early days of AIDS. And they happened to have used a typeface of mine, and I thought, you know, this was a good cause. This was excellent. The same week that I saw that, a friend of mine came back from Las Vegas. And in Las Vegas, you know, they're not allowed to have brothels in town. They're all outside of Las Vegas proper in mm-hmm. Nevada in the desert. But they have flyers, they have brochures that you can see on the street corners advertising them. And somebody brought one of these back, which was set in the same typeface. So now what does that tell you? I mean, here is two sides of the same sort of coin in a way. But I have no control over that. You know, I might be pleased if the government uses a typeface of mine for a cause that I'm pleased with. But if I pick up a magazine and it's perhaps I don't happen to agree with their politics and I see they've used a typeface of mine, there's nothing I can really do about that, you know.
No so angry letter. Please remove this.
I would say that that's not ever happened to me. I suppose, I don't know. I mean, it's hard to say. Hard to say how I would react if I felt strongly enough about it. But type designers are generally very powerless in that sense. It goes out
because
in the world.
You're actually only making the tool. And
exactly.
Really
you're making the raw material. It goes out there, somebody licenses it, they acquire it legally, correctly, and they can set anything in it they like. We don't really, of course, we don't see except a fraction of what is done in a certain typeface, but we may like it, we may not like it, but there's not much we can do. Yeah. I mean, not to go on about it, but I mean, I suppose it's possible that I could be approached by a magazine that was a very right-wing political magazine or something that I wouldn't like, and I might be tempted to say to them very honestly, you know, I don't agree with your politics, and you know, I would be more comfortable if you didn't use my typeface. Whether they would listen to me or not, I don't know. But you know, I might.
But then you'd be.
I could imagine a circumstance in which I might say that.
But then you'd be in the position to actually say no directly to the person that
well, if it was a new typeface, yes, I could refuse the job, just like a graphic designer approached by a client they don't like, say, well, I prefer not to work for you. thank you very much. If it was a commission to do the new typeface, yes. But if this was an existing typeface, they said, we're going to use your Miller typeface, which has been on the market for several years, I might say, well, I have feelings about that typeface and I would prefer for you not to use it, but they might just say, screw you, we're going to use it anyway. Nothing I can do.
Going back to the shorter questions, does it bother you that you don't vote living in the States?
Not very much. I mean, when I lived in England, I did used to vote. When I had a vote in England, I voted. But somehow when I lived in England, I was closer to politics, or I had an illusion I was. I have never become an American citizen, not really because of the voting issue, but because when I left England, I mean, it's over 20 years ago now, I was invited to go to the States, and there were very good business and technical and entrepreneurial reasons to do what I do in the United States at that time. So unlike a lot of people who go to live in the United States, I was not thrown out of England. You know, a lot of people, after all, in America are there for political reasons because it was not good for them or sometimes dangerous, of course, for them to live where they were born and so on. So the Americans are very hospitable to such people. But that was not my case. I mean, the British didn't say, go away, you know. So I have never changed my nationality. And I think that I'm, as people go, I mean, you know, we're living in a political climate at the moment because of what America's been doing in the world recently, where issues of nationality and ethnicity and religion and so on are very much on people's minds. But for me, I'm not someone for whom nationality is terribly important. I rather like the sense of moving around the world and not necessarily belonging anywhere in particular, you know. I mean, I'm not an anarchist, but I'm not someone who necessarily wishes to be closely involved and to be very patriotic or something or other. I'm a little bit more removed from some of these issues. And this is by choice. I mean, this is not just being lazy about taking out American citizenship. Whether I'll ever go back to England, I don't know. The British are very... You can always do that. I mean, I could always go back, of course. But whether I will or not, I've no idea. You asked me if I had plans to retire. My retirement plan is death. So
okay.
Oh, that's clear.
Yes.
Downloaded from typeradio.org. All Type Radio interviews and podcasts may be downloaded for personal use only and may not be used in any other way by third parties, except with prior written consent from Type Radio.